I do express concern. I am concerned about an escalation. We know what the U.S. record of regime change and nation building has been like in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, in Iraq, or another country in Latin America, whether it's Guatemala, Haiti, Cuba, or elsewhere. And I think that that's a critical issue that can unite most people. You may not like Maduro, but you also have to think of the terms of what is national sovereignty, what is independence, what is the rationale behind an intervention. And any opposition force that supports an intervention, a military intervention, in many ways is not asking for a change, but it's asking for them to be replaced with them.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome to Deep Focus. All eyes this week are on Venezuela and on what the White House intends to do about Venezuela. Frankly, everybody's got an idea, an opinion, but we really don't know. Should we expect to see the United States actually put ground troops in Venezuela? Are we just sitting with our fingers crossed, collectively that is, that Nicolas Maduro gets on a plane and runs off somewhere? Or is this about China? Even beyond that, is this really just Donald Trump bluffing? And is he going to announce next week some grand idea that we're going to have peace with Venezuela and everybody's going to be friends again? Who knows? I don't know. But our guest probably does. I'm very happy to welcome Professor Miguel Tinker Salas. He is one of the world's leading experts on Venezuela. He is Emeritus Professor of History and Chicano, Latino Studies, and author of Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know, and The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Society in Venezuela. He currently teaches at Pomona College, and we're happy to have him. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I don't mean to make light of the situation in Venezuela. Of course, this is a very serious thing. On the one hand, we've got the White House ordering drone attacks on boats that we're told are drug boats. I'll tell you from my own time as the senior investigator on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, I actually looked at drug trafficking from and through Venezuela, and frankly, I couldn't find any. Certainly, Venezuela is a way station for individuals involved in the drug trade or for some of the cartels, but it's really Colombians using Venezuelan territory to sell their drugs. I never saw any evidence or any intelligence indicating that the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, was involved in drug trafficking. But the White House is saying that, no, we have it all wrong. Do we have it all wrong? What are you seeing here?
Well, first of all, I think you're correct. This is not about drug trafficking. I think that they've created the notion or the idea or the narrative that Venezuela is a producer of cocaine and of fentanyl, none of which is true. According to U.S. intelligence services back in March and April, they reported on Venezuela. It said there is no fentanyl production in Venezuela. Most of the precursors all arrive through Mexico or other countries, so that Venezuela does not produce fentanyl. I can only imagine the face on the generals when Trump asked them to produce targets that produce fentanyl in Venezuela, and they had to tell him, well, we can't find any. And as you pointed out yourself, U.S. intelligence reports that maybe less than 7% of cocaine traverses Venezuela en route to Europe, not the U.S. The very notion that these launches that are being attacked in the Caribbean were headed for the U.S. or represented a clear and present danger to the U.S. or had to be blown out of the water because they were going to the U.S. is absurd. This is not about drug trafficking. So then what is it about? It is about reengaging and assuming the position of hegemon of the U.S. in Latin America. The target here right now is Venezuela, but long-term the target is Cuba. Long-term the target is Nicaragua. Long-term the target is Mexico. This is about in many ways, reasserting U.S. hegemony, which it had lost in some ways in the last 20, 25 years with the rise of leftist governments in Latin America. This is about China. This is about displacing China. On September 2nd, when the U.S. announces it is destroying boats of the Caribbean, China was investing $1 billion in oil production in Lake Maracaibo to try to reactivate wells that have been left behind 20 or 30 years ago. So this is not about drugs. This is about a change in government. This is about reasserting U.S. hegemony in the Caribbean and in Latin America as a whole, where China is the dominant economic exchange for most of South American countries. So again, this is not about drug trafficking.
You know, it was always my understanding. I'm not an oil analyst, so please feel free to correct me and ridicule me if you'd like. But it was always my understanding that while Venezuela is sitting on an ocean of oil, it's a very dirty, very high sulfur content kind of oil, and that you need a specialized refinery in order to take the sulfur out of the oil, and that those refineries exist in South Texas. That's why even when our political relationship with Venezuela wasn't always the best, we had very strong economic ties. It was all based on this oil and the refining of the oil. Then a couple of years ago, it was during COVID, the Chinese announced that they would build a specialty refinery in the Caribbean on one of the islands. Is that true? And if it's true, is that a threat to, I'm going to call it, American control over Venezuela's oil, that the Venezuelan oil wouldn't be refined any longer in the United States?
Well, it hasn't been refined in the U.S. for a while.
The sanctions killed that, didn't it?
Except for the Chevron license, which is about 100,000 barrels or 200,000 barrels a day. Chevron has a license. Interesting that while the ships are being blown up in the Caribbean, Chevron is still pumping oil in Venezuela. Interesting that while Trump has declared the no-fly zone, Trump has also requested that American planes bringing back returnees, Venezuelan returnees, would be accepted. So that's going on. But you're right. Venezuela has 303 billion barrels of oil. That's supposedly. But it's heavy crude. And heavy crude, as you pointed out, requires solvents and requires special mechanisms to process it into a sellable quantity. So heavy crude was good for heating oil, but it's heavy in sulfur, so it's not good for the gasoline production that we're so accustomed to with oil. So the U.S. in Houston, where all the refineries were at, is where you had the actual refining process. The Chinese began refining in their own country, so as did the Indians, who also began to produce oil or buy Venezuelan oil. So Venezuela, despite the sanctions, has been selling oil, but it's had to sell it at a discount because it has to go through a series of transshipments and masking boats where they're at and where they're going to and how they're getting there. So in that context, many countries have benefited from the sanctions by buying Venezuelan oil at a discount. But yes, undoubtedly, the larger issue here is that, yes, everyone says it's about oil, but they don't add what you added, which was the fact that it's heavy sulfur. It requires dilutants. So you have to buy those solvents from Algeria. You have to buy those solvents from the U.S. So there's that irony of dependence that goes even further. Venezuela is dependent on its oil production, its oil revenue, but it has to buy solvents to refine it and to make it actually sellable on the world market.
Given Venezuela's efforts to cultivate new alliances during this very strange period in relations with the United States and what the United States is trying to force in the form of diplomatic isolation, and there's this threat of U.S. military action, of course, how do regional and global power dynamics shape the prospect for negotiation versus escalation? Is there any effort right now to try to talk the United States back?
There was. In fact, Brazil, Qatar, other countries have been involved in a process of trying to establish negotiations. Maduro himself floated a couple of days ago that there was a deal underway that approved by the Chinese, but then Maduro had backed out. That could be black ops. We don't know if it's true or not. But there has been efforts at negotiation. In fact, the current crisis arose after the Biden administration negotiated certain conditions for elections in July of 2024. And those elections are the ones that now are the condition under which the Trump administration claims that Maduro is not the legitimate president and that therefore they want regime change. But they wanted regime change before this. They wanted regime change back when in 2002, when the coup happened under George Bush, the son. They wanted regime change in 2015 when Obama declared Venezuela a clear and present danger to the U.S., even though, again, it didn't have a Navy or an Air Force that presented a challenge to the U.S. So it wasn't a clear and present danger. It was an effort by Obama to throw red meat at the conservatives when he was opening up relations with Cuba. So they wanted regime change in 2019 under Trump when he established maximum pressure and recognized Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela, along with 60 other countries, and mounted an offensive on the border with Colombia, claiming that they would see the ouster of Maduro. They wanted regime change in 2019 when there was a coup by Guaido and Leopoldo López against him. They wanted regime change in 2020 when there was a former Green Beret who proceeded to try to carry out a coup in Venezuela. So again, the idea of regime change is not new. The context for it has changed. Now it's under the auspices or under the umbrella of narco-terrorism, because if you declare narco-terrorism, you create the context in which the U.S. claims to have the legitimate authority to intervene in Venezuela, which it does not have.
You know, I'm going to ask you a question that may sound rhetorical. It's actually not rhetorical. I really mean it. I was having a conversation earlier today with a friend who noted the use of these made-up terms, and we were laughing about the term Islamofascism, which the Bush administration tried to make widespread in its use around 2005. It didn't catch on, and people don't use it anymore. It turned out to be a talking point from the Republican National Committee that had come from a PR firm. But the term narco-terrorism, to me, sounds like it is coming from a PR firm. If you look at the word terrorism, it is the attempt to effect political change by instilling terror among the civilian population. So what is narco-terrorism? The words don't even make sense when they're put together like that. What are we supposed to take from this vis-a-vis Venezuela?
It sounds like an oxymoron.
Yeah, it does.
But the reality is that with the war on terror after 9/11, the media and the narrative was the war on terror. The Trump administration has made an issue of the question of drugs. Here's an irony. They're talking about wanting to stop drugs, and yet they just gave a pardon to Juan Orlando yes. Hernandez, the former president of Honduras, who actually was involved in drug trafficking, was convicted in a U.S. court, not by Biden, but by a jury that was selected, a federal jury that found him guilty of trafficking 400 pounds of cocaine into the U.S. That actually said, if I remember right, the quote, "I want to stuff cocaine up the Americans, the gringos' nose." I think that was the actual use of the term. So again, the narrative shifted when Trump gets into office the second term and wants to reapply maximum pressure on Venezuela. And the context becomes it's part of the war on drugs. Yet there's no money for public health in the U.S. There's no money for addiction. There's no money for the things that might actually prevent drugs from having a market in the U.S. And never address the question of addiction in the U.S. or why people are using fentanyl or why they're using methamphetamines or why they're using cocaine. That's the reality. As long as there's a market in the U.S. and the U.S. is the largest market for illegal drugs in the world, there will be someone to supply it, whether it's Colombians or whether it's somebody else or whether it's Americans, because we tend to think of cartels only in Latin America. What happens when those drugs cross the border? Someone is trafficking them. Someone is moving them. Someone is delivering them. There are cartels in the U.S.
That's a good point. I had a podcaster ask me a question earlier today, and it was whether or not Nicolas Maduro had won the 2024 election. And I said, it was my understanding that he had won. I know several people who were there as election observers who came back and said that what they had seen was that he had legitimately won. Certainly, conservatives are saying that the election was stolen. There were accusations of the CIA being involved in one way or the other. Do you believe Nicolas Maduro won the election? Is he the democratically elected leader of Venezuela?
I think the fact that they failed to produce the actas, or the actual ballot regular from station to station, raises the doubt about the election. And that's the fundamental issue here. Now, the opposition claims that they have all the actas. I find that claim also to be problematic, because I just don't see any way that they actually have all the ballot records. Right. So I think there's a quandary here in terms of Maduro. The idea that some Macedonian hacker broke into the National Electoral Commission and stopped the counting of the ballots, I also found kind of ridiculous. I was there for the July 2024 elections myself. I walked through the entire process. I saw the process. People participated. There were hundreds of thousands of people on the streets waiting in line very diligently to vote. So I know that there was a strong participation. In some ballot areas, there was Maduro support. In some areas, he had no support whatsoever. So I think that in that context, the issue is complicated, problematic, but I think that if he had won cleanly, they would have provided the ballots.
What does the role of Venezuelans who are in the United States and will be returning to Venezuela, whether or not they want to? Maybe some are being expelled. Maybe some decide to go back. Whatever the situation may be. Are there enough Venezuelans? Are there enough anti-Maduro Venezuelans who might go back and change the outcome of the current political situation, or even democratically in the next election?
There are 650,000 Venezuelans on TPS, temporary protective status. The Trump administration has withdrawn that. So here we have another interesting conundrum. That is, you are claiming the government is authoritarian in Venezuela. You're claiming that it's a dictatorial government, yet you want to send people back to that government. And again, the people who are the immigrants, the exiles, are constantly caught up in the middle here as pawns in a process, both by the opposition and the government. And in that sense, it's tragic. And it's difficult to rationalize, but they're also being caught up in this. The Venezuelan diaspora is millions.
Yes.
Venezuela was not a country that actually had migrated because of oil profits and because of the condition of the economy. There was poverty in Venezuela. Let's not kid ourselves. What gave rise to Hugo Chavez was the inequality. What gave rise to Hugo Chavez was the conditions that existed in Venezuela, that so-called pacted democracy. The people are fond talking about the richest country in Latin America that had poverty, and that had large numbers of people who were poor. And that system was corrupt, and that system is what caused the rise of Hugo Chavez. And that is undeniable. But people tend to forget that. They want to rewrite the narrative. We want to go back to the past. We want to recapture that grandeur past. That doesn't exist anymore. The reality is much more complicated. But yes, there's another part of there. So there are many levels or layers to that exile community. Part of that exile community is the leadership of the opposition,
right,
that now reside in Madrid or in Miami and have Marco Rubio's ear. We hear Trump say they're opening up their insane asylums. They're opening up their jails. They're sending them all to the U.S. That's straight out of the opposition playbook. Coming from Maria Corina Machado, from her segment of the opposition, because again, there's also different segments to the opposition. There's Maria Corina Machado's group, González Urrutia, Leopoldo López, and others. And you have other members of the opposition, and not all of them support a U.S. intervention. I think it's important to highlight that there are different layers within that opposition itself. They may all be united by wanting to get Maduro out, but that doesn't mean they support a U.S. intervention. So again, to bring back to your question, part of the exile community is what has Marco Rubio's ear. He is their representative. He is their spokesperson. He is in many ways carrying forth their agenda, and in many ways is driving this policy.
Let's talk about prospects for American intervention. I want to get your thoughts on what intervention might look like. You mentioned, for example, that Venezuela doesn't have an air force or a navy. It doesn't.
No, it does have an Air Force and Navy, but it just doesn't have one that can compete with the U.S.
That's what I mean. We send one aircraft carrier battle group there, and that is enough to defeat, I think, the Venezuelan Navy. But can you see things getting to that point? Already we know that here in the United States, there isn't going to be a congressional debate. There isn't going to be a declaration of war. There isn't even going to be a vote on the use of force. This is going to be a unilateral action taken by the White House. But what might that action look like? Can you envision troops on the ground in Venezuela? Or would troops on the ground really mean troops in Caracas? Or might we be seeing something more secret, a CIA action against the Venezuelan government? And even then, what would that look like?
I don't think we're going to see boots on the ground. I don't see that actually happening. While doing my own research in Washington and the National Archives, the military archives, I found in 1946 a plan to invade Venezuela. I found another one in 1948 written by the military attaché, and it had all the conditions. It had ships coming in from the U.S. It had bases in Cuba and Guantanamo. It had bases in Panama, bases in Colombia, bases in Aruba, all of them contributing to an intervention. And then it also had the component of a large American expat community living in Caracas and living in Venezuela as the intermediaries for this invasion. And that, again, was that it had three plausible reasons. A foreign power has invaded Venezuela. Venezuela has a rebellious government that won't sell oil to the U.S. And third, there is social tumult that doesn't allow for oil production to take place. So oil was a factor in all three of those. And they actually had, as a condition, setting up a conservative government that would align with the U.S. So those are interesting factors in a 1948 report around an invasion of Venezuela. So I don't see boots on the ground. It's the old adage, if you break it, you own it. And if you're going to go into Venezuela, you have to think about what happens the day after. What happens? What do you do with the Venezuelan military that up until now has remained loyal to Maduro? What do you do with a political apparatus that up until now has remained loyal to Maduro and that is entrenched in every position of power within Venezuela? How do you replace that? How do you are able to create a context for governability? Can you govern? Will you descend into chaos? Will there be factions of the military creating territories that are theirs? Oil-producing territories in Maracaibo will fall under the control of a certain group, another territory under the Orinoco Basin. Those are all the challenges one needs to confront, because I don't think you flip a switch and all of a sudden you transfer a country from what has been a very complex authoritarian government into a so-called democracy without repeating the same process. So I foresee, and the talk on the street in Caracas, I spoke to a friend this morning, is that there might be an attack directed at a particular military target, similar to what happened in Iran with the U.S. bombs the site and claims that it obliterated everything and that the issue has been resolved. But I do think that the flotilla has a lifespan. I don't think it's there forever. But I do think something important to highlight, if the larger issue is China, if the larger issue is the U.S. hegemony, that fleet will stay in the Caribbean for a long time and will be playing a role in the Caribbean for quite a long time.
What do you see as the potential roles of countries like Colombia, for example, which until recently was joined at the hip with the United States militarily? It's different right now. Or Cuba, or China, Guyana, now that Guyana has found great wealth in new oil discoveries.
And Trinidad and Tobago.
That's right.
Opening its bases for the U.S. military to practice as they did during World War II. And it's in the base was called the Gaza Strip, by the way, the military base in Trinidad, where the U.S. destroyers used to attack German submarines, was called the Gaza Strip. I think that we saw is the realignment. I would take your question and frame it this way. Why hasn't the U.S. looked for a multilateral force? Because it has opponents in Brazil. It has opponents in Colombia. It has opponents in Mexico. Countries that are not willing to join the U.S. and that under the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis would have joined and did join the U.S. in trying to sanction Cuba with the missile crisis. In here, They're not. That speaks to the changes in Latin America that have happened in the last 20 years, where the U.S. is not the dominant power. That's why it relies on military power when it can't rely on political power or economic power. In that context, it's an important weakness that the U.S. is exhibiting in the context of Venezuela as it tries to militarily muscle its way and affect regime change. So those are the countries that are the leading countries in the region. But again, there is a right-wing tendency in Latin America right now. We saw it in Argentina. We saw it in Ecuador with Noboa. We've seen it in other countries in Latin America. We see it with Guyana, because Guyana has a vested interest in its relationship with Exxon and maintaining its control over the oil deposits that it has found. So again, that's the background. That's the context in which we're dealing with and in which Venezuela is dealing with. And that in other circumstances might have seen a multilateral force aimed at Venezuela.
Before we dive into the next segment, I'm going to do our very first commercial. So here goes. And here's something you may not be hearing about. While you're distracted by headlines, a real transformation is underway, and that is the rise of the digital dollar. 134 countries, including the United States, are developing central bank digital currencies. That means this: your transactions could be tracked, your spending controlled, your savings vulnerable to instant freezing if the government decides to do that. This is what the current public policy is moving forward. Bureaucrats and those suspicious former colleagues of mine at our nation's three-letter agencies would love nothing more than to have more information about you. The government calls that innovation. We call it financial surveillance. American Alternative Assets has put together a free guide that shows you how to protect your retirement with physical gold. It's called The Digital Dollar Trap, and it's something every freedom-minded American should read. Inside the free guide, you'll discover how to protect yourself from government overreach with physical assets like gold and silver. Go to johnlovesgold.com right now to get your guide totally free. Again, that is johnlovesgold.com. Because the dollar is going digital and you are going to need something real. Our first ever commercial. Okay, back to the important thing. I wanted to go a little farther afield if I could. You're such a well-known expert in this region that I wanted to ask about Venezuela's current relationship with Mexico. Mexico, of course, has oil. Venezuela is awash in oil. Historically, they have had generally good relations over the years. It ebbs and flows like relations do between any two countries. Is Mexico, do you think, able to take a leadership position in this current situation? Maybe to the point of convincing the United States that armed hostilities with Venezuela really are not the way to go.
Well, but if we go back to the Trump first administration, his Secretary of Defense, Mark Epsi, in his book talked about how Trump asked about launching cruise missiles into Mexico. Lest we forget about that. Mexico is also a target of the Trump administration. In the last iteration of his comments on Venezuela, he mentioned that Colombia was in the sights, that Mexico was also in the sights. I fear that Mexico is also in a very vulnerable position. Its economy is so integrated with the U.S. economy that it's the old adage that when the U.S. catches a cold, Mexico gets pneumonia. It's the old adage, poor Mexico, so close, so far from God, so close to the U.S. So that in that sense, Mexico has certain vulnerabilities and they're constantly being targeted, even though there is a free trade agreement between them. The Trump administration doesn't respect it. It wants to renegotiate it. So Mexico is looking at its own situation, its own challenges in dealing with the Trump administration. And plus, it has an active issue with the cartels that actually do produce fentanyl and that actually do control some territory and that are that are a constant challenge to the state and state sovereignty and its ability to exercise control. So in that sense, I don't think that they are able to play the role, the outsized role that they may have played in another context. Colombia has become also a target of the Trump administration. In this last iteration of his comments on Venezuela, he mentioned looking at land targets, and he said land targets in Venezuela as well as in Colombia. So in that sense, he opened up a specter of possible intervention and land attacks in both Venezuela, Colombia, and in Mexico.
In your book, The Enduring Legacy, you argue that oil reshaped everyday life and the notions of citizenship in Venezuela. What parallels or even contrasts do you see with today's debates over resource nationalism and energy transition in Latin America? Are you seeing history repeating itself?
No, I think that era has gone past. Although there's a legacy that remains, and that is the all-powerful state that controls the purse strings, that controls the economy. Because again, oil was nationalized in 76 in Venezuela, 75, and then officially in 76. And oil, the control was over the question of who controlled the Ministry of Petroleum and Hydrocarbons, who controlled the board of directors of the nationalized oil industry, PDVSA, Petroleums of Venezuela, because whoever controlled that controlled the economy. To the extent that the oil company wanted to isolate the state, or at least to create a Maginot line around itself to avoid state intervention, created some of the context under which Hugo Chavez could attempt to renationalize the oil company. But I think in the context of what we've seen more recently, I see it very difficult. I think that magical state that Fernando Coronel talked about has disappeared. I think that context has disappeared, that people don't see oil as prosperity anymore to the same extent that they saw it at one time. It's an unfortunate outcome. And it's back to what Juan Pablo Perez Alfonso, the prime minister, the minister of oil, said in the 60s, oil in Venezuela is the excrement of the devil.
I want to switch, if I could, to U.S.-Mexico relations. You have written a great deal over the years about the U.S.-Mexico border and about the longstanding cross-border ties that the two countries have. I mean, all over Texas, we have Mexican mayors who actually sleep in their houses in Texas and then cross the border for safety reasons, cross the border the next day to actually administer their cities. But we've got businesses straddling both sides of the border. We have ranchers that straddle both sides of the border. How should historians' understanding of the border region inform current policy discussions, discussions on migration, discussions on security? How are things changing?
I think that the context for that integration it varies, so that you have areas like Nogales, or Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, where that integration is lived in a daily basis. As you point out, people live in El Paso. They may have their economic activity in Ciudad Juarez. Tamaulipas, the same thing. So it varies. San Diego is much different because San Diego has a buffer between itself and the border. It has the Chula Vista, has National City, has San Isidro. So it created a buffer around its own interaction with Tijuana, and it was one of the cities that least had influence with Tijuana in the context of a border relationship. I think what's missing sometimes in the national debate are the voices from the border. We always said if we looked at how people got along without the influence of Mexico City or D.C., except that image actually evaporated under the Clinton era, when you have the Border Patrol exercising a greater role along the border in Ciudad Juarez, El Paso, with Operation Gatekeeper and Operation Lights on the Border, et cetera, and people on the border actually supporting it. So we found that border culture, border society was not sufficiently strong enough to create a new society, to create a new context. Many scholars argued, we have a new culture, a new border culture. It is a mixture. It's Mesoamerica. It's Mexico and the U.S. Carlos Fuentes, the Mexican author, wrote about it in his book on the border. But the reality is not. The border plays out All the asymmetrical relationships that exist between the U.S. and Mexico on a more concentrated level, on a more clearly defined level. And although there are 40 million people that cross the border between San Ysidro and San Diego every year, the most populated border crossing anywhere in the world, where the first world meets the third world, it is also now an area where the rest of the world, the third world, meets the U.S., as we saw with African immigrants, Cuban immigrants, Haitian immigrants, Venezuelan immigrants, Afghani immigrants, Somali immigrants. So that border is no longer just a binational border. It is an international border and has been transformed by what's happened in the last decade.
I want to ask you also about your own career at Pomona College. Looking back on your teaching career and your work in Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latina studies, what changes have you seen in how students understand Latin America and Latino identities in the U.S.? Over the years, this must have changed dramatically since the 1970s. What challenges remain?
Well, I think that the change has been dramatic is that the Latino community itself has changed. It's no longer simply Mexican dominant. We now have everywhere in the U.S. a strong Central American population, an increasingly large Caribbean population, Haitian, Cuban, Dominican, the same thing for South America. So that the composition of the Latin American population in the U.S. has changed dramatically. So that if you look at Chicano Latino studies, it is facing a challenge of how to deal and how to address those significant changes. It has to recognize its Mexican base. 60% is still Mexican, but it also has to recognize the fact that diaspora has produced significant dramatic changes in how we envision the Latino population in the U.S. Not to think of it as a hegemon, not to think of it as a uniform body, but with all its complexities, with all its class differences, with all its racial and ethnic differences, that's the context in which to envision the Latino population. And that explains why a certain segment voted for Donald Trump in the last election and why today that segment has now seen the light and support for Donald Trump has decreased significantly among that Latino population. Many of them thought that when he talked about deporting the bad hombres, in quotes, it didn't mean them. But guess what? It does mean them. As we saw with that young student in Boston traveling to Texas to visit her parents for Thanksgiving, who was deported within 2 days and is now in Honduras, even though she had a protective order.
Just crazy. Before I let you go, I have to ask you, if you were a betting man, would you expect to be at war with Venezuela in the coming weeks or months?
Well, we could argue that we're already at war.
Well, that's a good point.
When you establish a flotilla of dozens of ships off the coast, when you bomb boats unilaterally, when you claim to control their airspace, the reality is controlling airspace is an act of war. And I think that the U.S. Congress is remiss in not forcing the administration to address these issues, as we saw with Hegseth, in double killing the individuals, which is a violation of the Geneva Convention, a violation of the UN Convention, a violation of every norm of warfare that exists. You don't kill individuals that have been already neutralized in an act of war. But I do express concern. I am concerned about an escalation. We know what the U.S. record of regime change and nation building has been like in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, in Iraq, or another country in Latin America, whether it's Guatemala, Haiti, Cuba, or elsewhere. And I think that that's a critical issue that can unite most people. You may not like Maduro, but you also have to think of the terms of what is national sovereignty, what is independence, what is the rationale behind an intervention. And any opposition force that supports an intervention, a military intervention, in many ways is not asking for a change, but it's asking for them to be replaced with them.
Professor Miguel Tiker Salas, thank you so much for joining us. Professor Salas is Emeritus Professor of History and Chicano-Chicana Latino-Latina Studies and author of two books, two books on point here, Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Enduring Legacy, oil, culture, and society in Venezuela. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Pleasure's all mine. And ladies and gentlemen, I would ask again that you do me the personal favor of liking, subscribing, sharing, tell your friends, tell your family. It's only because of you and support from you that we can continue to have these interesting and in-depth conversations. So thanks again. I'm John Kiriakou. You've been watching Deep Focus. All the best.